Welcome to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry.
Nothing has been done. This time, that can't be true. This time, we must actually do something. The question now is, what will the Congress do?
That was President Biden earlier this month, addressing the gun violence epidemic taking so many lives in our country. And on Sunday, a coalition of 20 senators, 10 Republicans and 10 Democrats responded to the question.
What will the Congress do?
When they announced reaching a deal on a package of gun legislation. And while it falls short of many of the provisions the president had been supporting, including expanding background checks, an assault weapons ban, and raising the age requirement to purchase some guns, the deal does include one critical component: bipartisan support. The participation of 10 Republicans suggests the group would have the 60 votes needed to defeat a filibuster and pass the Senate if it goes to a vote. President Biden tweeted, "It does not do everything that I think is needed, but it reflects important steps in the right direction. With bipartisan support, there's no excuses for delay. Let's get this done." To discuss this weekend's bipartisan framework, let's talk with Jennifer Massia, reporter for The Trace, a nonprofit newsroom reporting on gun violence in the U.S. Jennifer, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
All right. What was your reaction to this weekend's announcement that there is a bipartisan deal to at least do something?
I was surprised. I was surprised that they had 10 senators on board from the get-go. That is something I was not expecting. The provisions have some things that were very much sought after by Democrats, but they fall short in a number of ways. And one of the things that surprised me the most was that there's a measure in there closing the boyfriend loophole. This is something that almost sunk the Violence Against Women Act reauthorization not that long ago. So the fact that Republicans were on board was surprising to me. And what that does is it includes dating partners in lifetime gun bans for convicted domestic offenders. Right now, the only people that applies to are current and former partners, current and former cohabitants, people who've lived together, co-parents, and family members. And the fact that this was in this framework was kind of a shock because it has shut down negotiations in not just Violence Against Women Act, but several bills in the past.
All right, I just want to be sure that I absolutely understand the, as it's called, boyfriend loophole. So prior to this, one would have had to have either been married, an official domestic partner, or a cohabitant, right, having lived together. But now we're talking about a proposal that will ensure that if a person has a protective order against someone, even if they haven't lived with them or haven't been married to them, that it also can create a lifetime ban on that person's capacity to have a weapon. Is that right? I just want to be sure I'm clear about it.
That is correct. And, you know, that was really important because the majority of domestic violence is among dating partners, people who haven't lived together, people who don't have children together. And so a 1996 federal law implements a lifetime ban for people who have just been convicted of misdemeanor domestic violence. But that lifetime ban did not extend to dating partners. So that left out about, you know, half of convicted domestic abusers. And it's said to be very effective at saving women and others' lives if abusers are separated from firearms.
All right. So I want to go to another key aspect of gun deaths that we sometimes don't talk about in the context of media, where we do tend to focus on things like mass shootings. We are here today on the 6th anniversary of the Pulse nightclub shooting 49 lives. I think there's lots of reasons, you know, why media, you know, focuses our attention there. But we do know that death by suicide using firearms is actually the leading cause of firearm death, and that red flag laws seem to be helpful in that. What's going on with red flag laws in this agreement that was made over the weekend?
So the framework, even though there's no text right now, the framework is said to include financial incentives for states that pass red flag laws. Right now, there are 19 states that have red flag laws, and those are laws that allow police, family members, school officials, healthcare providers to petition a judge to temporarily disarm somebody who might be a risk to themselves or others. So under this law, the remaining states would be in line for federal funding to get these programs started. Now, that's not a nationwide red flag law. That is not a nationwide system, a federal system that allows you to petition to disarm someone. So it does fall short in that way. I mean, this is something Republicans have forwarded as an alternative to mandatory red flag laws in the past. And incentivizing red flag laws is all well and good. But as we've seen with the Medicaid expansion, which 12 states still have not adopted, incentives might not quite be good enough for nationwide adoption. There will be some holdouts. But if this does pass, red flag laws have been shown to be effective at reducing violence in a crisis, whether that's a mental health crisis, whether that is a mass shooting threat. And studies that are out of the two earliest adopters of red flag laws over 20 years now, Connecticut and Indiana, show that they were most effective in preventing suicide. So when somebody is in a mental health crisis and they are temporarily separated from their guns, the crisis passes, the suicidal instinct passes, and they're able to regain ownership of their firearms with no blemish on their record, so they can still buy more guns in the future. So it has been shown to be an effective tool most frequently with suicide, and it was intended to stop mass shootings.
I want to dig in on red flag laws just one more step here. So part of it is that you have to be deemed high risk of potential harm to yourself or to others. Is there concern that these red flag laws might disproportionately target, for example, people of color?
I mean, gun law enforcement has been historically racist in America. The one time Republicans actually backed gun control was, you know, after Black Panther showed up armed at the California State House in the 60s. You know, one of the reasons, the main reasons the right to bear arms even exists was for white colonizers to subjugate indigenous and enslaved people. It's woven into the DNA of America, which is one of the reasons it's so hard to change. So gun reforms that rely on police to enforce them will always be used to disproportionately imprison people of color. Their sentences are higher. They're more likely to be shuffled into the school to prison pipeline and saddled with criminal histories from a very young age. So every subsequent penalty, particularly for gun charges, just are exponential. Researchers have found that support for red flag laws is lower among people of color because they distrust that the system will be fair, and they have, you know, every right to think so. One good thing is that red flag laws are civil. They are not criminal. They don't generate or add to a criminal record. But it is easy to imagine a scenario where a judge authorizes a search of someone's home under a red flag law and police find something or plant something that could trigger criminal charges. These are not out of the realm of possibility in the United States. Examining these gun reforms, though, through the lens of racial justice is something that's new to researchers. And, you know, since 2020, I've seen a renewed commitment to do that, including with red flag laws. There was one study a couple years ago from Johns Hopkins of gun removal orders in Seattle, and it found that Black people were overrepresented by a factor of nearly 2 to 1 compared to the county population. So, you know, the study said, you know, the states that implement these laws, you have to look at the unintended consequences of what these laws do and the fact that people in over-policed populations will have more difficulty using them.
You talked about the framework, as it's written, providing a carrot, right? A federal carrot for red flag laws for the states. I'm wondering here about the stick, which has been historically the gun lobby. Is this carrot enough to convince states that might be reluctant, given the capacity of the gun lobby to wield quite a big stick?
Well, this is a framework, as you said, and things will be whittled away. It already starts from a point of compromise. So to see it whittled away anymore will be difficult for supporters of these policies. But what heartens me is that some of the senators who are on board are, you know, they're pretty staunch Republicans. You know, John Cornyn, who has indicated willingness like to fix the background check system in the past, but not go as far as Democrats want. You know, he's a Texas Republican. You've got Tom Tillis from North Carolina, Roy Blunt from Missouri. You know, these are, you know, pretty dug in Republicans. And the fact that 10 of them are willing to stand up for this legislation, it gives me some hope. You know, they're people who what the NRA says and does maybe doesn't affect as much. They're established in the Senate and they're established in their home states. And, you know, that is heartening.
Jennifer Massia, reporter for The Trace, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
One of the biggest challenges in trying to pass gun control reform, the outsized influence of the gun industry. We've been thinking a lot about these red flag laws, and last week I spoke with Cole Wist, a former Republican state representative from Colorado, who told me about the challenges he faced in trying to enact a red flag law there. Wist represented House District 37, which encompassed parts of Denver's suburbs. So as a Colorado state rep, you had an A rating from the NRA, and yet in 2018, you sponsored a red flag gun bill. Can you talk to me about what was the content of that bill?
The event that triggered some inquiry by me as a legislator related to a very violent event that happened New Year's Eve of 2018. And it involved an individual who was known to law enforcement. He had made numerous threats, not only to law enforcement, but also to some folks at the University of Wyoming. He certainly was known to his family to be someone who was struggling with mental illness. And he had made a couple of calls to the sheriff's department to come out to his apartment on New Year's Eve 2018. And as a result of that interaction with law enforcement, the deputy sheriffs had made a decision to take this individual on and what's called an M1 hold. And an M1 hold in Colorado is an opportunity for law enforcement to remove a person from their home, to take them in for a medical evaluation to determine whether or not they need some type of immediate care. And the unfortunate thing here was as the officers were attempting to remove this individual on an M1 hold, he barricaded himself in his apartment. And as the deputy sheriffs entered the apartment, he ambushed them and tragically killed one of the deputies and injured a couple of others. In the aftermath of that, my question as a legislator was, you know, is there some public policy that we could look at to make sure that law enforcement, who were putting in a very difficult situation, interacting with someone who was suffering from mental illness, volatile, and clearly had a lot of firearms in his possession, was there something that we could do to make sure that that interaction between law enforcement and that individual was more safe? In the course of examining that issue and looking at it, discovered that 19 states have passed extreme risk protection order laws, commonly known as red flag laws. One of the first states to pass a red flag law was Indiana. And Indiana did that with a Republican governor, with bipartisan leadership, with both parties coming to the table to really talk about this, not as a gun rights issue, but as a public safety issue. And that's really how I approached as a legislator. Are there ways for us to move past the traditional fight about gun rights and gun control, which I think really has folks talking past each other rather than to each other, and really focusing on this as a public safety issue and giving law enforcement and family members tools that they could use to keep themselves safe?
I have to say, I am often surprised that law enforcement aren't a more vocal group about this kind of legislation, because it does seem that in many ways they might be most like sort of literally on the front lines of needing to address the crises that occur when those who wish ill and are prepared to do ill are heavily armed.
I think that's completely right. I mean, look at the position we put law enforcement in every day. They really are on the front line of so many aspects of difficult circumstances in society. We expect them to be folks that enforce the law, that we expect them to be social workers. We expect them, in some cases, to be family counselors in a domestic violence situation. And, you know, many times law enforcement officers go into a domestic disturbance call, not really knowing what's on the other side of the door, whether or not there are guns there, whether or not there are weapons there, whether or not there's someone there going through a serious mental health crisis. So that was really, you know, my primary motivation, and that is trying to protect these men and women in uniform who are serving our community, trying to keep us safe and giving them a tool that I think that they could use. You know, I had support from the law enforcement community who came out and talked about the importance of this to keeping law enforcement safe. But I'd like to hear certainly more from law enforcement about, you know, why this is a useful tool.
Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back with more on The Takeaway.
This week's On the Media, one former NPR editor's grievances are reverberating far beyond a Substack essay. He claims wokeness is ruining the place.
That marginalized people are storming the barricades and dictating that this story happens and this story gets killed and we're going to use this language and not use that language. That's not what I saw.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, we're back with former Republican Colorado State Representative Cole Wist. Wist sponsored a red flag gun bill in 2018. He previously had an A rating from the NRA, but was moved to action when a sheriff's deputy responded to a call and was shot and killed by someone with a history of mental illness. Wist sponsored a red flag gun law, which passed in the Colorado House, but was struck down by the Republican-led state Senate at the time. And for Wist, who left the Republican Party this year, sponsoring the bill had consequences.
I think there are folks within the gun lobby who feel like any discussion of a topic that relates to gun ownership is betraying the Second Amendment. To contrast that, I think, you know, there are those of us who believe that we can protect the Second Amendment, but talk about this from a public safety standpoint. And really restoring the concept of responsible gun ownership, I think is an important one. Too many times the focus in this debate is on objects and not on people. And after every one of these mass shootings and in the more recent case of the tragedy in Texas, we again heard, you know, folks talking about red flags or mental illness or some type of, you know, mental health issue. My response to that is that if the issue is risk factors that are created by people, then let's talk about what those risk factors are. And let's be proactive and find ways to combat what I think are acts of domestic terrorism and ways to protect the public safety. And of course, we have to balance that with the Second Amendment. But there has to be room for discussion, and folks have to try to look for common ground. And my sin as a legislator and what the gun lobby did not appreciate here was my willingness to have conversations and to try to talk about this and find common ground with other folks.
You say your sin. How were you punished for that sin?
The gun rights groups actively campaigned against me in my reelection. You know, they put flyers out suggesting that I was for gun confiscation and was against the Second Amendment, and that I wasn't for, that I was against folks having the ability to protect themselves, which couldn't have been further from the truth. And if you looked at my voting history on Second Amendment issues, I was a very strong supporter and continue to be a strong supporter of the Second Amendment and folks' right to bear arms. At the same time, there are rights on the other side, and that is the right to public safety, and frankly, the right to life that folks in our community have. And if our leaders are truly representing everyone, I think it's incumbent on them to listen to folks on all sides and to try to find common ground and try to find public policy that protects public safety.
I'm interested, as a lawmaker, sort of how you experienced that resistance from the lobby. What I hear from you is that the lobby has the capacity to convince your constituents that your position is actually something different than what it is. And so I guess I'm wondering, as a lawmaker, what you see as the potential ways to have real conversations that can't be just mischaracterized by the lobby.
There's just so much fear that grips this issue. And when you can't even have a conversation about this, let's say you don't even introduce a bill. If you just have a conversation about this, you're accused of betraying the Second Amendment. There's a one recent example I can give you. John Cornyn, senator from Texas, after the Uvalde shooting, had openly said he was willing to have conversations about legislation to address gun violence. And there was immediate backlash. And there was a tweet that was sent out by a radio talk show host in Dallas who had said, you know, John Cornyn, you better not be doing this. And immediately John Cornyn responded by saying, not going to happen. So it was, for me, a real-time example of the power of the gun lobby and how quickly Republican members of Congress respond to that. Legislators are there to try to solve problems and to craft public policy to address issues. But if some solutions are completely off the table because you're afraid of the political repercussions for taking on a particular subject, then I don't think you're doing your job as a legislator. And frankly, that's a complete cop-out.
There are those who would say, yes, it matters to protect life in the perspective of addressing death by gunshot wound. But I was sent here to do a lot of things. And if someone just introducing a red flag law is going to get me thrown out of office, then I've got 15 things I was elected to do, and I can't sacrifice those 15 things to this one thing. How would you respond to that?
What's more important than public safety? We're talking about people's ability to send their kids to school and not have them be killed. We're talking about people having the ability to go to a supermarket and be safe, or to go to a movie theater and be safe. Let's say we weren't talking about shootings. Let's say we were talking about an epidemic of mass stabbings happening across the United States. I could certainly bet that Congress would be looking at this closely and trying to design policies to make sure that folks who were going through a serious mental crisis didn't have access to knives. But as soon as you inject the word guns into this conversation, it really freezes the debate. And everyone goes to their political corner, doesn't talk to the other side. They do nothing. You know, and the shock and outrage that we experience after one of these horrible events fades after a couple of weeks, and everyone just sort of goes back to business as usual.
Do you feel any hope on this issue?
I'm hopeful, but I remain skeptical of Republicans seeming to fall back into the same old talking points on this issue. But if we've gotten to the point in our country where 19 kids being shot in their fourth grade classroom is an acceptable part of living in the United States, then, you know, I fear for our future. We can't become so numb to the shock and devastation that we're unwilling to act. And I sincerely hope that this time will be different.
Cole Wist is a former Colorado state representative. I so greatly appreciate you taking the time today.
Thanks, Melissa. My pleasure to be with you.